No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez. We hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in at 1-888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. Thank you for being here tonight. Maria, are you with us?
I am, Michael. Hi.
Hi.
Happy Memorial Day weekend.
Happy and boy, Memorial Day weekend.
I have a fabulous time in your city, and getting to see you and Mrs. Brown was one of the highlights for sure.
Oh, come on.
It's all true.
Right. Well, it was a highlight for Mrs. Brown, I can tell you that. and me. I'm not to say it wasn't a highlight for me. But let's talk about your trip to Washington and what you did.
Okay.
And let's start there.
So I was there. I landed on Thursday afternoon, and you and your wife graciously picked me up and took me to this venerable steak place that you explained had been around for 70 years. And what is that? Yeah. Is that, was that part of DuPont Circle where we went?
Yeah, you were just below DuPont Circle, but that's the neighborhood.
Okay.
You know, if we have lots of neighborhoods in Washington, like 60 neighborhoods, and that's the DuPont Circle neighborhood. And Annie's Paramount Steakhouse is not only famous because it's been there for so long, but because the LGBT community is in basically in the DuPont Circle area. Annie's was like the first place to give free meals to AIDS patients and, you know, people with AIDS. And they just were known as a place with a really big heart. And when I worked at the DNC, we ate there every chance we got.
And it was wonderful. And the fact that it had such tradition also, because, you know, 70 years for... I mean, there are houses that are not that old in, where I yeah. live, so I mean, yeah. to have a place. And then it was the International Communication Association annual conference, which was at the Hilton where I stayed. And so that was Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Actually, it's going through next week, but I have another conference that starts on Wednesday in the San Francisco Bay Area. So... I can only stay so much. I guess I'm like a hummingbird. I light a light and then I take off. So that was wonderful because two of my professors were there. And Fielding Graduate University, where I'm getting my PhD, has a satellite office in the Capitol Hill area of Washington, D.C. So got to take a tour of those facilities and meet those folks. And then we all went to lunch on Friday. So it was just fantastic. Getting to be with the professors, you know, in person and spend some quality time with them and other classmates was just really, it makes it all worthwhile.
Well, and you know, you stayed at a historic place too. The Hilton that you stayed at was where Ronald Reagan was shot coming out of a fundraiser. Lots of fundraisers are done at the Hilton because it's got the largest ballroom in Washington, D.C.
And so, that ballroom is three stories down.
Yeah.
Which people were saying, well, wait, one of the conferences is on the ballroom level. And I said, I think that might be downstairs. But I can't imagine that they're going to have these black tie galas and send people down three floors.
Yeah, that's
what
they do.
That was news to me. And then because you had told me that, I told my professors and classmates about that. And Friday I attended a pre-conference event at the National Press Club, and there was the Pulitzer Prize winning photograph of President Reagan on the ground with all of the flurry that went on there afterwards. And so that just reinforced everything, because you had told me that just the night before.
Well, and you know what? It's amazing when you look at those photographs, first of all, how prepared the Secret Service is, because as President Reagan is falling to the ground, there are Secret Service agents pulling out semi-automatic weapons, that like long, like Uzi machine guns that they're carrying. I mean, they were all around them. They wrestled the guy to the ground. But it also shows you that one really committed nut, there's not a lot they can, you know, they can do, right?
It's
all about screening and making sure the right people get in and the wrong people don't. You know, they just released this guy.
Yes.
On Hinckley.
Yeah.
A lot of people were upset about that.
And I didn't realize, and pardon my ignorance, but again, until you explained that there was collateral damage because somebody was killed.
Yeah.
President Reagan was hit, but he wasn't killed. Yeah. But you said, was it a D.C. police officer?
Yeah, D.C. police officer. You know, the Secret Service, I don't know if they still do this, but very often they use the D.C. police to do things like scan the ballroom. This was a guy that was the dog handler, you know, the guy that went through the ballroom with the bomb-sniffing dog. It's something that we complain about because we don't get reimbursed for this sort of thing.
You mean the District of Columbia?
Right.
Yeah, which leads us to today's event that you were prominently participant in, and that it will be no longer because of some of those reasons, right?
Well, let me tell you something. Lots of people stood up and said, we're going to carry this on.
Did they?
Yes. And actually, President Trump tweeted out yesterday that if they have problems getting permits, he'll get the permits for them.
Really?
And of course he could do that, you know.
Uh-huh.
And one of their big problems, and I just can't get over this, is that the Pentagon charges them $52,000 to park their motorcycles and use the porta potties.
Really?
52,000. Yeah. They charged the veterans 52, you know. And so that was part of my speech today, is that I used to be the administrator of a public interest group that had a thing called the Defense Budget Project. And we found out that the Pentagon was paying $800 for toilet seats that went on airplanes. And, you know, and that was my line that got a big applause, was I said, if they can pay $800 for a toilet seat, you ought to be able to pee for free. You know, people went, yeah, you know, right? They're veterans. It's crazy.
So let's rewind, because Rolling Thunder 32 was today and you rode in it and then you spoke afterwards. So let's go to what your morning was like. Give us a time frame and what you did and where you went and et cetera.
First of all, I'd rather be around no people in the world rather than veterans. Veterans are, you know, military people are just the nicest, most gracious people. They embrace everybody. They're such camaraderie and such acceptance of everybody that's there. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to be a part of. So I go and they put me right up front. I was like the third motorcycle out of 500,000. So
now, how did they find you, or you find them out of 500,000?
I got to tell you how well organized they are. I go and lots of the roads are shut down, but the police let me through because they ID me. Then I get there and I talk to somebody, one of the marshals, and they say, okay, we'll get in touch with the, you know, the big shots. And they did. And they sent a cop over, and the police, I got a police escort over to the front of the line.
So you got to where everyone was assembling, and then they maneuvered you around that mass of bikes to the front. And do you think there were 500,000 bikes there?
I don't know. I didn't count them, but there was more than I could count. I'll tell you, there were a lot of them. And, you know, and that's the thing. The Pentagon parking lot is gigantic, and it was covered. It was absolutely full. I've gone in past years, and it's taken an hour and a half to empty out the parking lot. The ride starts at noon, and it only takes about 15 minutes, 20 minutes, but then the program doesn't start till 1:30 because it takes that long for everybody to do that 15-minute ride and get over to the Lincoln Memorial. You know, that was the greatest thing for me. I got to speak in front of Lincoln Memorial where, you know, Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, where Marian Anderson sung on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial when they wouldn't let her sing at Constitution Hall because she was black. You know, there's such history there on the mall and adjacent to the Vietnam Memorial. And so it was really great. It was really great to do that. And I'm there with like Gold Star moms. There were 20 Gold Star moms. There was one lady who drives a Harley that's made, completely made, except for the engine, is completely made out of the Humvee that her son was in when he was killed.
Oh, dear.
Yes, he was the gunner in the Humvee. And he pushed another guy down when the Humvee turned over, and that guy lived. And unfortunately, he didn't get down quick enough, and he died. And his comrades, the men in his unit, took the Humvee apart, and they built a frame out of it, put a Harley engine on it. They took the headers off of a car that he had to make the exhaust, and the paint job alone must have cost thousands of dollars. His pictures on the bike, and at one time, this is the saddest thing I heard all day, is the names of everybody in his unit were on the front fender, but the front fender was knocked off, and his mother lost all her teeth in the front because they threw rocks at her going to a military funeral.
You're kidding me.
No. I just couldn't imagine. She had to tell me the story twice because I was like, what do you mean? They threw rocks at you? And they said, yeah, people threw rocks at me. I just couldn't believe it.
When did that happen? Did she give you a time frame?
No, she didn't give me a time frame. But I'm kind of thinking, you know, it was probably shortly after the Vietnam War, you know, that I don't know if it was in the Middle East or not. But she didn't tell me.
Because Rolling Thunder was dedicated to the Vietnam War veterans, but subsequently has taken on the other veterans from the subsequent wars that we've been involved in. So
right. it was started by four Vietnam veterans.
And my understanding, the main guy is still alive.
Yeah, well, Artie Muller, who's the guy that leads it now and has kept it alive for 32 years, was not one of the four original guys, but he's one, but he, many people call him the founder because he was right there, right after the four of them got together. And he's the one that keeps it going. I don't know about the other four. There's at least two of them that are still around because I met them today. But, I think the guy that came up with the original idea, I don't know if he's still there. It was originally started because this guy, strangely enough, came to the Lincoln Memorial when he was in Washington, D.C., and he met a guy who convinced him that there were still POWs in Vietnam who had not been released. And so they started this to put pressure on the government and to remind them that there are people that are unaccounted for. And it really is dedicated to MIAs and POWs. And according to Rolling Thunder, there are 86,521 people that still are unaccounted for. Now, 72,000 of them are from the Second World War, but 7,600 are from Korea and 1,600 are from Vietnam. They're still trying to get all of those people accounted for. And there's actually a thing called history flight. And these people have found 350 of these people from the Second World War, mostly. And they've actually identified 100 of them and returned their remains to their families. The most recent one is Private Fred Freak, who was lost 76 years ago and was just returned to his family.
My goodness. What a story and what a legacy.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me, Michael, what time did you get to the Pentagon parking lot?
11. They were fine. These guys start out at 6 o'clock. These guys start out at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, so the good news is the system works. They had communication. Do you have helmet laws in the district?
Yeah, we do.
Okay, so everybody had on a helmet.
Not everybody, but, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, a little lax at times like this, but yeah, most people and most, you know, as a former Harley owner, you know, that there's lots of people out there with helmets on that say things like helmet laws suck. You know, these guys don't like helmets, but yeah, most of them had helmets on, and I met just some wonderful people, just, you know, wonderful people. People, you know, the guy next to me was from the university. He's a professor at the University of Kansas, a veteran, and used to teach at Georgetown. And he brought his granddaughter with him. His granddaughter looked to, you know, if I had to guess, I would say she was, you know, between 18 and 21 or 22.
Did she ride with him?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Did many people have passengers?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, I bet you. Oh, yeah.
How nice.
Absolutely.
So you take this short and simple route. You get to the other end. You're there an hour before the event starts in terms of the speaking engagement. So are you busy milling about and chatting up people?
Yeah.
And now, was Karen with you at that point?
No, Karen, Karen, I'm sure Karen was there, but yeah, pretty much there with me at that point. And I mean, I'm sure she was there by the time I arrived, and some other people showed up. My friend Rick rode in from Leesburg to be there, and some of the other people, like Anise Jenkins, who's been on our show, showed up.
People get to the Lincoln Memorial if they weren't in the ride?
Well, Anise took an Uber.
Okay.
It's not.
And Anise, it could drop you off close enough?
I guess it did, because, but many of the streets are closed off. So, you know, Anise is a trooper, though, so I wouldn't be surprised if she walked a pretty good distance.
Yeah, hell's half acre. Now, and the forecast was supposed to be 91 degrees, was it?
Yeah, it was 88, and it rained a little bit just before my speech, so I lost a few people. But, you know, I mean, I hate to get all schmaltzy about this, but they had a guy come up and sing. They had a band, you know, and one of the songs they sang was God Bless the USA, the Lee Greenwood song. And I mean, I would say 200 veterans in the front stood up and held hands and sang a song along with the guy on stage that was singing. You know, and it's a lovely thing to see this, to see these people that stood up for America, who you know, were soldiers and have given so much, and still want to, you know, and still are proud to be Americans and still are proud of their country and everything they've done. You know, even when the Pentagon charges them $52,000 to use the Twas, I think I was more angry than the veterans were. You know, they went and looked for other venues, by the way. Oh. You know, and they couldn't find one big enough and close enough. You know, the Pentagon is right over Memorial Bridge, so it's very close to where
Lincoln
the Ryan,
Memorial.
Yeah, and uh-huh. and also Memorial Bridge. You know, Memorial Bridge, for those listeners who may not know, it connects D.C. with Arlington, and at the end of at one end is the Lincoln Memorial, and at the other end is Arlington Cemetery. So it has a lot of military significance. You know, so they come over Memorial Bridge specifically because, you know, it's so important. And Memorial Bridge, there are four gigantic statues on each corner of the bridge. They're amazing. And they were a gift from France after the Second World War. So the bridge has a lot of significance to veterans, but they look for other venues. I mean, I find it so hard to believe that the Pentagon didn't say when they were looking for other venues, oh no, God, no, don't go anywhere else. We want to support this.
Well, how about some fee reduction or waiver because of what the event is and what it draws and what it means?
Yeah. How about a fee reduction of zero? You know, they paid $800 for a toilet seat.
So tell me, do people who ride in that have to register and pay a registration fee?
No. And that's what somebody on Friday night, I went to the Blessing of the Bikes.
Did you? You said you were going to try to, but you had such a big, busy day on Friday.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was wonderful. It's at the National Cathedral. Have you been to the National Cathedral?
I don't think I have, Michael.
Well, next time you come to Washington, we'll go because it's the greatest cathedral in the United States anyway. I mean, it rivals the European cathedrals. It took over 100 years to build. Took 103 years. They just finished it about 15 years ago. But it's just an amazing facility. And
then
I
haven't been, for sure.
It's a Woodrow Wilson is buried there. They have a stained glass window that's made out of a moon rock. The Apollo astronauts gave a moon rock to be part of the window. And, you know, it's just got such a great history. But anyway, I would say they had about 40 clergy. That's how many they needed to bless all the thousands of bikes that showed up for them.
And did they show up in the parking lot for the blessing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In front of the church, in the parking lot, around.
How wonderful.
Thing. Yeah. They were everywhere. And,
did you take pictures of these things?
Yes, I did. I actually tweeted one out. And it's funny, one of the people that was blessing the bikes was my former parish priest. So I said, please. And then she blessed the bike, and it's another priest came along and blessed the bike. And I said, that's okay, because I'm really, really old, and a double blessing is probably exactly what I need. You know, and that's how I started out when they asked me when I got to the memorial today, and people came up to greet me, and they said, you know, how are you doing? And I said, I got here. I didn't kill anybody. I didn't hurt myself. I didn't run over any small children or, you know, so I'm happy, you know.
I'm not behind bars for crimes
I'm
committed
not behind bars, right, exactly.
On the wheels of my Harley. So do you have any idea from the organizers where the bikers came from?
They came from all over the country. including the guy, and I'm sorry that I can't remember his name, but he played, he was the star of Terminator 2. I don't know if you've ever seen the Terminator movies.
Just the first one.
Well, in the second one, they have a guy who's a robot, who's a cooler robot than Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Arnold Schwarzenegger comes back to protect the people, and this is the ultimate robot, and he's there to kill everybody. So it becomes a fight between him and Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he's a booze fighter. Do you know the booze fighters?
Nope.
The booze fighters were the original motorcycle, outlaw motorcycle gang in California. The movie that Marlon Brando did, where they took over a small town in Northern California, I think it was called The Wild Bunch, was about the booze fighter. That was a real incident where this motorcycle gang in the 1940s, late 40s, early 50s, took over a small town in Northern California, and they had to call in the state police, the state troopers from all over the state to come and restore order. But he's not only an actor, he's a booze fighter. He owns a Harley dealership. That's what in San Diego.
Oh, and my gosh.
And he rode from San Diego.
Did he?
Yeah.
So I wonder if they were the foreshadowing of the Hell's Angels.
They were. One of the guys, Sonny Barker,
yes,
who started the Hell's Angels, was first a booze fighter.
Okay. Wow.
They were.
Nice little circle of history. Because then Sonny Barger and George Christie kind of took it from there, and then they've had bad blood between the two of them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Wow, what a story that... So, because having been in Sturgis with 500,000 bikes, I know what that looks like.
Yeah.
But Sturgis is a town of normally 6,000 people until... Right. It happens in August. You were all in one place because in Sturgis, there's like three outdoor venues where they have the concerts, and you know there's rides to Mount Rushmore, and there's all kinds of rides, et cetera. But I can't imagine that must have the chrome glistening in the sun must have been blinding.
Well, you know what? They're not at the memorial, and not everybody comes to the memorial because there are different venues here, but they all park nearby. So
okay.
When you're walking around and you see fields and fields of these motorcycles, you know, tens of thousands of them parked all over the mall area and all the adjacent areas to the mall. And the better thing was that I bet there were 50,000 people along the parade route.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So
and
I was told
that's part of the 500,000. I don't think they're all, you know, there's 500,000 motorcycles. There's probably 350,000 motorcycles, and
still,
you know, that includes passengers and people that come, and nobody that lives in Washington D.C. was here today. I mean,
right.
You know, they clear out. They know they're coming. The parade route was lined with thousands and thousands of people holding up signs, we love you, God bless you, thank you for your service, waving American flags, hollering. I mean, yeah, it was great. It was just, you know, if you needed something to invigorate your soul,
so that's what I was told while I was there, was people in D.C., you know, scram because it's of the density and the closures and all that, but the people who come in, they're a huge boon to the tourism, to the hotels and the restaurants and the shops and the sightseeing and everything else. So everyone was scratching their head like, don't get it. Why somebody wouldn't want to encourage this again? Like, because everyone else was talking about that this was supposed to be the last one. So it had D.C. a buzz. You know, I'm just a fly on the wall and I'm not in the trenches like you are, Michael. But I was really impressed with how much everybody seemed to know and how concerned they were about that.
Well, you know, that's like with the permit things. You know, I talked to these guys and I said, look, that's what you want to say to the city, right? These guys are veterans. They're not, it's not their modus operandi to start trouble. Their modus operandi is to end trouble. So they're people that care more about making sure that everybody gets a share rather than making sure that they get theirs. You know what right. I mean? These are the kind of guys and women that pull over when they see you broken down on the side of the road. They don't drive by and say, oh, isn't that a shame? They actually pull over and see if there's something they can do to help you.
Yeah.
You know, that's who they are. So they don't sit down and say that. But I said to them, I got no problem. I got no problem sitting down with the mayor and saying, you know what? You want to lose a couple of million dollars worth of business?
For local more businesses? Than that.
Yeah,
more than that.
That'll make you really popular.
Well, and you have to have those conversations soon because, you know, events like this take a year to plan.
Yeah, yeah. Well, these guys got it down. Let me tell you, they didn't miss a beat. And and that's what I was going to say when I was at the Blessing of the Bikes. Some guy walked up to me, some veteran from Iowa, and he said, you know what? There's 500,000 people that come to this thing. They come from all over the country. He said, you don't think people driving from Iowa to Washington would kick in $5? He said, if you got $5 from everybody that rides in this thing or that's part of this thing, you'd have $2.5 million.
Well, that's why I asked about a registration fee.
Right.
Because, I mean, every poker run that I've been in or any charitable ride, you pre-register and it's nominal. It's $25 or it's $35 if you don't pre-register. And usually it includes a T-shirt, too, right. So that you've got something that says the day and the date and whatever.
Well,
and normally because it also benefits a cause. Like I was a Grand Marshal several times for a breast cancer rally that was put on by the Harley dealership. And we did this loop and then it ended up with lunch and entertainment and a raffle and all that sort of thing. But money was raised to go to a cause.
Well, Harley was there and I talked to the Harley people and they said, yeah, we've been part of this since it began almost. And we make a contribution. Well, I'd love to know what their contribution is, because if they gave 50 cents for every Harley that was there, they would, you know, it would end up being $250,000. And I'm sure they're not putting that into it. But there should be 100 vendors that want to kick in for this. You know, people, there are 18 million veterans in America today. So, you know what? Lots of people make lots of money on veterans. But again, these guys don't want to ask for your money. They want you to show up because you care. You know, so it's not their modus operandi. But, you know, I told them, I said, look, I argue about crap all the time. I said, you need somebody to, you know, knock on Harley's door. I'll fly to Milwaukee. I'll talk to them.
Well, it sounds to me like the organizers started with a sweet and simple and pure concept, and maybe now they need to monetize it somewhat to make it practical.
Right.
Necessarily have to worry about fundraising, because that's a full-time job in and of itself.
Right.
So if you can defray the costs of the event with the people who are in it, I think that's a win-win-win.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. And I think you're right. I think that's why they're hesitant to do it, because they don't want it to appear that it's about money for some reason. You know, they wanted to keep it pure about commitment of people to this cause. And everybody that works for the organization is a volunteer, and they announced that they have a foundation, and the foundation gave away more than $250,000 last year. They don't use the money to put on the run. They give it away to veterans charities.
So I saw they have a board of directors, so that they're like legit in terms of how they run their organization. But did they say how the funds were distributed to what entities or to what?
Yeah, I can't remember, Maria, but they did. They did talk about a few initiatives that they funded with the money. Yeah, but I just can't remember what they were. But they were all veterans causes. But here's an even better thing. The Gold Star mothers come up to me. First of all, I got to hug a zillion of them. Look, if you don't know what a Gold Star mother is, it's somebody that's lost a child in combat, usually, or in the military. I don't think I heard a story where any of these people that were lost were they were all in their 20s, 21, 22, 20, 20, 23. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. And they came up to me because they have just had their local sales tax certificate revoked, and they've had their parking permits revoked in the district. They can't park outside the building that they work out of. They have to pay to park. Now, again, how do you say to a mother that gave her son to America that you got to pay to park and you got to pay sales tax? I mean, there aren't that many of them. There's only, I mean, I don't know how many there are nationwide, but in the Washington office, there's only a half a dozen of these women that work, that get the permits. How much can they actually buy that they have to pay sales tax on? It's just criminal to me that they do this. And we, you know, and by we, I mean, I volunteered Karen. I said, you know, I'll take you in and sit down with the mayor. I want the mayor to look you in the face and say, I'm sorry you lost your son, but you got to pay sales tax.
And or daughter. But
your daughter. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Let's make sure.
My sexism is showing.
That we let our listeners know who this illustrious Karen is that you and I have both referred to.
She's a woman that does all the work. I get all the glory. She's my chief of staff.
Yes, and she does
all the work.
Damn fine job.
it's just amazing to me. I just read, and I talked about this too today, and I got a big cheer for this. I just read that there are 47 states who have gotten together to petition the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, to forgive student loans of disabled veterans. And my thought when I read that, you know, because it's controversial and they're arguing about it now, is why isn't this a no-brainer?
Yeah.
You went over and you lost your arms or your legs or you're blind or you have some other disability due to your combat, and we want you to pay your student loan? I mean, I just don't understand it. I don't understand. These people have so much respect for America. They have so much respect for every blessing that comes their way, and then they have to struggle. I just can't, it's just so hard for me to believe. One out of every three homeless people nationwide is a veteran.
Yeah, there's that figure is so troubling that there's obviously a breakdown in our system that is systematic, and that should be able to be identified and remedied.
Yes.
You know, mostly homeless people tend to have some mental health challenges. I think that's right. And when the outreach is done, sometimes they'll take advantage of the services offered, but around my communities, oftentimes they don't. They refuse it. But right. If you can identify that it's a veteran, there's a system that is there to support them specifically, regardless of what their challenges are. And that's what I don't understand about the execution. If we know that there's one in three, that means that there's one in three that needs our help.
Right. And you know what? You probably have a better grasp of this than I do. I don't know why this is, but PTSD is more prevalent among veterans who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, the more recent veterans, than ever before, than Vietnam veterans, than Korean veterans. PTSD is on the rise, and some of these veterans wait more than a year for treatment when they go to the VA.
Well, and some of that is the stigma involved with mental health. But
right.
I have a friend who was a Marine in Vietnam, and he has PTSD to this day.
Yes,
and he's been seeing somebody through the VA for decades. It's not something that necessarily goes away, although there it depends the severity of and when it happened and when you got help and what kind of help you got and et cetera. But it's something that can be managed. And that's, I think, maybe the message that needs to get out there. Plus, I'm hoping that the stigma of seeking help for mental health isn't what it once was. My folks live in the San Diego area, and there is a psychiatrist that lives in their neighborhood, and most of her practice is with service members who contract with her privately because they don't want the military to have on their record that they're seeking help through a counselor.
Right, I understand that. And you know what? Until you've seen PTSD in action, I don't know. You know, I've got to tell you, I have an experience from my childhood where I worked in a gas station when I was 16 years old. And we had a guy that worked there who was a great guy, very quiet, and but a really stand-up guy. He was a mechanic, a Vietnam veteran. He was probably in his mid-20s. They robbed the grocery store down the street from us. Normal guy, just the nicest guy. You would never know that he had any problems at all. They robbed the grocery store down the street. And Washington, D.C. is a city made up of alleys. So they brought in helicopters. This Grand Union was just a couple of doors down. They brought in helicopters to search the alleys. And we found this guy in the fetal position, crying hysterically on the floor of the gas station, on a lube bag. We called some people. They came. His family members, they took him, and I don't know, you know, I mean, I don't know what they did, if they took him to the hospital or whatever, but it comes to find out that he's been discharged because he was a radio operator in Vietnam, and he called in an airstrike, and the planes mistook his patrol for the enemy, and they killed everybody but him.
Oh, dear Lord.
Yeah. They killed like 8 men, and he was the only survivor. And the military investigated and decided that he was not at fault, that they just read the coordinates wrong or something, or they saw these men and assumed they were the enemy, and they opened fire so quickly that it was over in a matter of, you know, in a matter of minutes. But I'll never forget that. That left such an impression on me. And it's such a tough thing to deal with. And
well, the thing about post-traumatic stress disorder, Michael, is that when it's triggered and it's something, it's, you know, either audio or visual or what have you, the person that is experiencing the trauma cannot distinguish that it isn't exactly the episode that they first experienced that brought it on. Yeah, in other words, they go right back to that occurrence. And that's why sometimes their behavior is irrational, because they don't know that it's now 5 years hence, 20 years hence, whatever, because it takes your sense of history away and pulls you immediately to that with which they suffered. So through no fault of their own, they may react inappropriately or violently or illegally because they're back right there when it happened.
Well, I got to tell you, that was certainly the case with this guy. I can't even remember his name, but he was such a wonderful guy. And that was certainly, he was in such distress. And we were kids and we didn't know how to handle that.
I bet.
And luckily there was an older guy, you know, and he called, he knew how to get in touch with the family and they came and took him. And then he came back to work. I remember him coming back to work and it was a little while, but he came back to work and he seemed fine. But yeah, it was really, really, terrible. And you want to know another terrible thing?
I bet that back in those days, though, Michael, they might not have identified the disorder at the time.
Maybe
and they used
not.
To tell them to, you know, tough it up, or they'd give them meds to chill them out, right. Or whatever. We thank goodness psychology has come a long way and being more compassionate and understanding. My heart breaks for that man. How terrible for him.
Yeah. And you know what? Another terrible thing today. There was the Secretary of Veterans Affairs came and spoke. But other than that, and several generals, but a couple of generals, but other than that, not one politician other than Michael Brown. And what the hell is that on Memorial Day? 500,000 veterans assemble, you know?
And you're not running for re-election.
Well,
or election.
You know what? All these guys are out there running for election right now.
I know.
And they want to be the leader of the country. How about leading? You know? How about doing a little leading in your spare time? And not just,
Especially the veterans who are running for election, of which there are a handful. That would have been a nice opportunity, unless you think that it would have been pandering.
Well, no, and you know what? That's another thing that's really changed and really has changed for veterans. In the year that I was born, and I don't want to say the year because it's so long ago, but in the year I was born, 65% of all members of Congress were veterans. Today, less than 18% are veterans.
Wow.
So that's been a big change in America as well. So, we need a new mindset. And I really have a hard time saying this to you, Maria, but I care so much about you that I'm going to tell you, who do you think the big hero was today?
President Trump.
Every time his name came up, they stood up and cheered.
Did they really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He tweeted out yesterday something about, you know, how he wanted to stand up for Rolling Thunder and get them the permits if they needed it. But every time they invoked his name, they stood up and cheered. And you know what? The guys that organized this thing and got up there had some mean and nasty things to say about Democrats. And you know what? The Democrats better sit up and listen.
I didn't realize this was as partisan as you're suggesting.
Well, I don't. It's not a partisan event. I mean,
no, I get that. But
I didn't realize.
Me
to speak. But those guys, those men and women, I use guys generically, those men and women think the man in the White House supports them and that the Democrats don't support them. And the Democrats better step up to the plate because, like I say, there's 18 million veterans. That's a lot of voters. These guys are out going to rallies where 1,000 people show up. You know, how about 18 million? How about 500,000? They ought to have been there. Some candidates should have been there today. They would have let them speak. They would have let Democrats speak. They let me speak, you know, but they didn't show up. Not a member of Congress. Not a single member of Congress showed up for these people. And that's just amazing.
Do you think you have to be invited, or do you invite yourself, or do you know how that works, who they choose to be at the presentation as you were?
Well, Anish took an Uber and she showed up. You know what I mean? I'm sure if Cory Booker or Elizabeth Warren, Ted Cruz, any Republican showed up, they would have let him speak. Yeah, I mean, you probably, to get on the program like I did, you have to contact them. But you know what I had to go through? I called up the guy that runs it, and I said, can I speak? And he said, yeah. And I said, he said, do you ride? And I said, yeah. And he goes, do you want to ride in with me and the people that found it? And I go, oh, yeah, I do. Of course I do. You know?
So, well, and I don't know how to say his name, but Pete, how do you say his name? Pete Buttigieg or whatever?
Yeah, Beetlejuice is what I call him.
Okay, well, he's a veteran.
He's a veteran, yes. And there are other veterans as well.
Yeah.
And you know, Buttigieg, I think, is the right way to say it. And now he's the mayor of South Bend, I think.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe they have Memorial Day things going on in South Bend, but this happens the day before Memorial Day. So, you know, you could do both, right?
Right.
And I don't know why they weren't here. I met some incredible people today. I met the commander of the USS Cole. If you remember.
I do.
Cole, and he was a captain of the ship when it was struck.
You're
and
they kidding.
Lost, you know, and they lost 27 sailors. He said they didn't understand they were at war.
Well, I was going to say that was I don't know that we knew that was, for lack of a better word, a terrorist. But yeah. I don't know if ISIS has actually been found responsible. But it was the beginning of that. And we were still so innocent. Like, right. We knew we had been hit, obviously, and people had been killed. But I don't think we realized that it was a malevolent, bigger scheme out there than we probably just were too innocent.
Well, that's what he said. That's what he said. But I got to tell you, one of the more touching moments is when he hugged one of the Gold Star moms whose son was under his command and died in that incident.
Oh, you're making me cry.
You know, I mean, it made me cry. You know, these are amazing people. So let me just say, because we're running out of time here, and I'll give you the last word, but let me just say, if you've worn a uniform and stood up for America, God bless you for standing up for me and my family. God bless you for standing up for the country that I love. And God bless America. You know, I was an orphan. I was an orphan as a teenager. And I was a high school dropout that had no money. And I worked my way through college and started my own business and got elected United States Senator here in the District of Columbia. And I'm convinced there's no other country in the world that could have happened. So God bless America and God bless everybody that's ever stood up for it.
And you're right about the service. And I have to tell you this, Michael, I took Uber many times when I was in D.C. Mm-hmm. And I had a driver from Guinea. I had a driver from Egypt and I had a driver from Ethiopia. All three came here for a better life. All three became citizens. All three think this is the greatest country in the world. They use we when they talk about the United States. And they even said to me, you know, I'm an immigrant and I became a citizen, but this is still my country. So I hope you don't mind that I'm saying we. And I'm like, no, that's what makes our country great. And each one of them brought, you know, such gratitude to me because we're not as tarnished as some people might think we are. And according to these men who, you know, granted it's a random sample of humanity, but from those three countries, to talk about such pride about our country and to have left what they, you know, knew as near and dear to come here to start all over again. And here they are driving Uber. Some of them were going to college. One of them this morning, he had been a pharmacist in Ethiopia and he came here and he's re-credentialing and stuff. So they think that this is the greatest place on the earth. And all it did was re-validate the way I feel about our country. And I know you do too.
Well, we'll leave you on that note. And to every veteran out there on Memorial Day, this is for you, Lee Greenwood. God bless the USA. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks.
Thank you for listening.
My children and
Give the people their right to vote.